Today is Wednesday. It's June 22nd, 2022, and it's 2:39 in the afternoon. Hi, I'm John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals podcast, portions of which are broadcast on WGN Radio. Saturday nights at 8, you can listen to me weekdays from 10 to 2 on WGN.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
Hi, I'm Laura Washington, a contributing columnist for the Chicago Tribune. You can see my column weekly in the paper and online. And also, I'm a political analyst for ABC7 on very early in the morning most days, and then popping up and down in other places on politics.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the newly rebranded Grand Vizier of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter.
Grand Vizier?
Yeah, so I just an upgrade on my title, change of title. And I'm doing this in honor of course, of the Illinois Department of Natural Resources rebranding the Asian carp as Kopi today. So as I thought I should rebrand myself as well. So.
Vizier, is that a word?
Yeah, it's a high Muslim leader, the vizier.
Sounds way too close to Grand Wizard.
That's what I thought it was.
That's what I thought you said.
When I'm due for another upgrade, rebranding, I'll go with Wizard then, yeah.
So. Well, don't tell Elise in Palatine, who wrote to the Rascals since our last episode, "Hey, John Williams, why do you always start the podcast off with Eric Zorn when he's there? Is he the teacher's pet? I'd like to hear from someone else first sometimes." I don't know that we always go to you first, Eric, although we always give you your due on the introduction part.
Sometimes you let me derail the podcast, and other times you just go right by it and you ignore me. So,
well, when you're a grand vizier or whatever it is you are, don't you always get to go first?
I know.
I would think so. Yeah.
Let's start with this. The threshold for automatic speed camera tickets in Chicago is 36 and a 30. If you do 37, you get a $35 ticket in the mail. 1,000 such tickets are issued every day. Alderman Anthony Beal and 16 other alderpersons in committee voted to raise that threshold to 40 miles an hour. The mayor doesn't like that, but critics of the current camera threshold say it's a cash grab. The preys on certain neighborhoods and doesn't make us sufficiently safer. As the full council was set to vote on it today, the mayor's allies voted to defer and publish the issue. It's a tactic to delay the vote yet again to another meeting. To retaliate, Alderman Anthony Beal and Ray Lopez similarly voted to DNP all other business that came before the council. An exasperated Alderman Andrew Vasquez said at one point, "I'd like to be recorded as thoroughly embarrassed and ask our colleagues to cease and desist." Is this business that serious, or is this more a vote on the mayor?
Well, it's interesting that the alderman would say that they should be thoroughly embarrassed, and so what's new about that? I mean, there's been many interesting, crazy things that have gone through that council. Every week, you never know what's going to happen. I guess that makes it good for us reporters, but not necessarily good for governing in democracy. You know, you got to remember that Anthony Beal and Lopez are both viciously opposed opponents in the city council with the mayor and have been since the very beginning. So it's not surprising that they would be behind this. I think the issue that they have goes to the heart of whether or not this is a money grab. She's saying it's about safety, but in fact, there's been studies that have shown that the city's making a huge amount of money off of this threshold, this lower threshold. And she's actually made the case, the mayor's made the case, that that's important to put more money into public safety, put more money into other initiatives. But it also raises questions about her so-called reform agenda. She ran as a reformer. She said she was going to, you know, she was going to reach out to the less fortunate, that she was going to reduce these kinds of onerous fees and taxes to help that part of the community. And this looks like she's doing the exact opposite.
The city's transportation director said, "Remember, the first ticket's free. So if you didn't know there was a camera there, now you do. If you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime." And that, in fact, Austin, I shared this statistic with you from the city as well. When somebody's involved in a motor vehicle crash with a pedestrian or a bicycle and the car's doing 20 miles an hour, you have an 80% chance of surviving. If it's doing 40 miles an hour, the threshold they're asking for, you have an 80% chance of not surviving. So you, sir, who ride a bicycle 10,000 miles a year, should be in favor of the lower speed, right?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's 10,000. I think I've done 10,000 in the last 8 years I've lived here. It was my back of the envelope calculation. And of course, my experience is maybe not representative of everybody who's cycled or walked in the city of Chicago over the last 8 years. To Laura's point, really briefly, it's true that Alderman Beal and Alderman Lopez are no fans of the mayor. But what was interesting to me about the Finance Committee vote yesterday, that among the 16 aldermen who voted to repeal this were six members of her leadership team. And I think that speaks to how toxic this issue has become. And it's worthwhile to remember that the only reason that this policy is in place is because this change in the speed threshold was passed as part of the budget vote, the citywide budget vote. So nobody was really on the record for specifically, do you support ticketing people going 6 miles an hour over the speed limit? Now they will be. And these things are the bane of so many drivers' existence because they feel as though they can drive safely 6 to 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. And they, unlike people who commit much more serious crimes in the city of Chicago, there is a 100% enforcement rate of driving 6 miles an hour over the speed limit past a speed camera in the city of Chicago, and you getting a picture in the mail of your car from two angles and being asked to pay $35.
Aren't a lot of these cameras in places where it doesn't really feel like you're speeding? We're not talking about like little residential streets. We're talking about some main arteries as they go by parks and so on. And I certainly, you know, I've got cruise control in my car, and I'll just set it because I know that they're very sensitive, and I feel like I'm putting along if I'm going 32 miles an hour and cars are passing me at that speed. It doesn't feel unsafe to go 5 miles an hour over the speed limit, and I think that's where a lot of people are really angry about this.
But Eric, tell that to the people to the families who've lost their children and have lost other family members in bike accidents and car accidents. Today at the city council, there were large numbers of people that were outside protesting, advocacy groups who were saying we need to have more safety. We need to have more automobile safety in the city. So I guess I don't drive. OK, so I'm confessing right now. I don't drive. I don't own a car. That's one of the things I love about living in Chicago. You don't have to own a car. We've got such a great public transportation system here. But I don't get why you just can't drive under the speed limit.
I think the problem with some of the rhetoric around these tragic deaths. So, for instance, there was a cyclist who was hit by a car and dragged for, I think, a couple of blocks in the West Loop a few months ago. And that person was hit by a woman going like 50 miles an hour. And they found bags of heroin in her car. And I think when people are thinking of going 6 to 10 miles an hour over the speed limit, it's not going to catch, you know, cases like that. That is not applicable to that horrific tragedy, for example. And to Eric's point, slowing speeds and keeping pedestrians and cyclists safe is an admirable goal. The problem is these cameras are set up in a way where they're not changing behavior, because if they were, they would be declining. The number of tickets would be going down. And instead, they keep going up, which means it's not changing behavior around these cameras. And the problem is they are at these very, you know, 2-3 lane thoroughfares where people feel more like they're on a highway than on a residential street. That's because of the way that the street is designed. And you're sort of punishing people for a problem that the city created in the first place. And I think that's where people feel like they're getting ripped off, is that, you know, this is a very large street. There's no signals to me that I, you know, am really driving unsafely in this. I'm going with the flow of traffic and I'm getting tickets by the city.
How would we change the setup of the cameras? What could we do to make the cameras be more effective or to signal to motorists that they need to be aware of them?
I think that's a good question. There's plenty to be done, for example, of testing. Hey, what if you put a massive blinking sign at some of these places saying go below this limit and it shows you what your speed limit is? Could that change behavior as much, if not more, than slapping disproportionately low-income Chicagoans with tickets that they may not be able to pay and could lead to a suspension of their license, which could lead to their entire career and life falling apart, as many motorists have had their cars dispossessed by the city for seemingly small tickets like this. You know, these are only $35, but they can add up quite quickly. Well, and then I think it's all about street design as well.
And Austin, none of this, we're talking about like $45 million a year. This is the figure that the mayor's been throwing out as the hole in the budget that changing the speed limit is going to create. And to circle back to what Laura said at the beginning, Mayor Lightfoot campaigned on getting rid of the city's addiction to fees and fines. And this seems like she's just leaning into that. And going into this election, if you take off your public safety hat or your social justice hat and just say politically, what is this a smart thing for the mayor to be? She's really like going to die on this hill that she's going to make this election about speed cameras. And I don't think that with these protesters notwithstanding, I don't think that the 6 to 10 mile an hour ticketing threshold is popular.
I don't think she's getting that message. If it goes through, she's planning on vetoing it. So I think that she is going to die on this hill. But I think and I'm not here to defend the mayor. There's a lot that you can defend her on, but she believes that we need the revenues. Revenues have got to come from somewhere. Nobody wants to be taxed. Nobody wants to pay additional fees. We've got to come up with the bucks. She gets crucified every day for not putting enough money into public safety, for not putting enough money into the police department, for not putting enough money into anti-violence programs. So, I mean, she can't win.
I think part of the problem with the revenue is you probably couldn't devise a way to take as little money from people to generate more rage than this, to Eric's point on, because it hits so many. I mean, there's more tickets issued last year from these speed cameras than there are residents of the city. We're talking thousands of tickets a day. There's one every 11 seconds. So I think it is sort of this, it's becoming, I fear, one of those things where the mayor does not want to take a political loss. And that's what's motivating kind of this backlash. She published the names of all of the people who voted to repeal this and said, you know, basically sort of the blood is on their hands in the sense of if this leads to some kind of change in traffic incidents. But I really do think this is coming from a very grassroots feeling among Chicagoans. I mean, just on Illinois policy, we had around 7,000 people Chicagoans signed a petition to get rid of this. More than 500 people contacted their aldermen over the last 24 hours through our tool, our take action tool on this. It generates such anger among the people of Chicago. And that anger, unfortunately, like many policing for profit schemes, like we saw in Ferguson and many other places, it erodes trust in law enforcement because people think that the city's out to get them rather than keeping them safe.
And to the degree that you wonder, is it about safety or is it about revenue? It can be both. I would respect them at least a little bit if they said, and it's a good way to make money. I mean, we put a camera there and now we get $1 million a day or whatever it is. So, but they never cop to that. And so Alderman Beal said, hey, listen, put speed cameras on Lakeshore Drive and upper or lower Wacker Drive. You want some money, you'll get some money on LSD. And they don't do that. If it's good for Columbus Avenue by the radio station where my boss gets tickets all the time, how about we put it on Lakeshore Drive as well?
Absolutely. I don't understand why it's not on Lakeshore Drive. Is there some rationale behind the system that keeps these cameras only in the neighborhoods? Or
it might be a jurisdictional issue.
Yeah, I think Lakeshore Drive is not a city. It's a state.
It's a state thing.
So I'm sure there's some kind of shenanigans there. Like if you guys have ever had a breakdown on Lakeshore Drive, you got to call like five different agencies to figure out who could tell you. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen a state trooper on Lakeshore Drive.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's a jurisdictional issue, but it may just be one of those things where, Lakeshore Drive is an inland expressway, right? I mean, it's not supposed to be, but it truly is. And people speed there. The speeds there are 10, 15, 20 miles an hour over the speed limit all the time. And it doesn't even feel all that unsafe. Now, you don't have the pedestrian crossings there. You don't have the bicyclists on the drive that would cause some of these fatal accidents. I'm wondering how many accidents, they talked about traffic fatalities. And I think it was important if you're going to look at this issue to look at, okay, well, what percentage of those were committed? What how many fatalities were based on people going between 6 and 10 miles an hour over? Because as Austin points out, if you've got someone going 50 miles an hour in a 30 zone, that shouldn't be part of this conversation.
Right. And there's a decent discussion to be had for saying, you know, hey, if someone gets caught going 20 over, double whatever that fee is, because that's really dangerous.
Right.
But the problem is, I feel like with these tools, we saw the same thing with red light camera corruption in the city of Chicago, where John Bills went to prison for getting bribes from a red light camera company. They were caught shortening the yellow light periods below the federal safety standards to get more money. Like, city officials can't use these tools responsibly. And I think for that reason, they should just all be taken down. But to the 6 months, I think Beal's point is good, which is like, what's the limiting principle of any of this? Because if it's 6 to 10, why isn't it 1 mile an hour over to 6 mile an hour over? Isn't that speed difference causing the same amount of fatalities, same amount of traffic accidents? Why don't we just ticket everybody? And the reason is they know it would make people angry and people would feel that it's unfair.
That's why, isn't all of this really not about speed? I mean, it is about the cameras and the revenue, but is this about the mayor's desire to win re-election? And you wonder what the political gain is if she wins this fight. Does this help her in the election or does this hurt her in the election?
My sense is that it would hurt her, but maybe she's got a more of a long game kind of thinking here, which is that if you lose that $45 million, you're going to get more screaming in the long run than you are from people getting these tickets. I don't know. I mean, politically speaking, it doesn't look like it makes sense to me, but I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think right now, I mean, she's in bad shape with her own city council. I mean, you know, is Austin, you pointed out, she sent out this screaming press release condemning of the alderman who had voted against the measure yesterday. And, you know, there were several of them were her supposed allies. These are people that she's going to need. She's going to desperately need their help next year. And these are people that she's going to need endorsements from, people she's going to need if she continues as mayor. And she's alienating them. So that doesn't sound like a real winning argument to me. But, you know, she's got a lot of issues on the table, a lot of checkers she's got to move around the board. And maybe from her perspective, this is one she doesn't feel that she can really lose.
Why does anybody want to be mayor of this city anyway? I don't know what's a worse job to win, mayor or governor, probably mayor. The gubernatorial race continues to get interesting, and it looks like the polling hasn't changed much on Darren Bailey, the downstate senator's popularity. It still sure looks like it's going to be Darren Bailey versus J.B. Pritzker.
Well, yeah, the polls all seem to show that Bailey's got a commanding lead over Irvin, and there's some fear, I think, among the Bailey camp and also in the Democratic ranks that Jesse Sullivan might make a late charge. We've only got a week left here, and Sullivan has been polling right around 10% in the polls that I've seen. But they feel like he could be a much more attractive candidate than Bailey. The Democrats obviously think that Bailey is going to be really easy for Pritzker to beat. They've put a lot of money into this sort of bank shot campaign, saying, you know, Darren Bailey is too conservative for Illinois. Look at how conservative he is. And this is, of course, meant to excite conservative voters to vote for him.
And it's working.
Well, it seems to be working. I don't know who knows what is actually working in the race. Like the other thing that seems to be that Rich Miller reported today was that the Democrats are also sending out mailers touting the candidacy of Paul Schimpf, the Tribune endorsed somewhat more moderate Republican candidate. And I think the idea behind that seems to be, well, if voters are kind of hedgy about voting for Bailey, and they think, well, maybe I got to take a chance with Irvin, the Tribune mailer, or sorry, the Democratic mailer about the Tribune endorsement is supposed to make them feel comfortable voting for somebody else besides Irvin. So it looks to me like the Democrats are trying all kinds of three-dimensional chess moves to make sure that they face Darren Bailey in the fall.
Absolutely. I've seen commercials, Eric, that sort of match the description of the mailers that you're talking about. It's like television commercials on commercial TV the last few days that are paid for. It says that right down at the bottom of the ad, paid for by J.B. Pritzker's campaign. And they're saying Paul Schimpf's a great guy. The Chicago Tribune endorsed him. Here's what the great things the Tribune said about them. And here's the nasty things they said about Richard Irvin. And that's obviously a very direct strategy to try to help Paul Schimpf at the expense of Bailey and Irvin. But, you know, who, you know, they're doing this with Sullivan as well. I mean, they spent what, millions, but a lot of bucks. The Democratic Governors Association and the Pritzker campaign has spent a tremendous amount of money supporting ads that tear down all of the Republican candidates. I've never seen anything like that before.
I think it is millions. I think it's significant millions mm-hmm. dollars.
It's 30. The DGA is, the Democratic Governors Association spent $35 million between them and Pritzker in Illinois, which is bonkers. I there's no way that's ever been spent on a statewide race boosting a Republican candidate. My favorite Bailey Mailer, by the way, was the one, because it says he's too conservative, and then they say 100% pro-life. Like, what Democrat ever describes a pro-life person as 100% pro-life? You say anti-choice or against women's rights or something. And they're also doing it now. I think as of today was the first one I saw where they're backing Tom DeVore, who was sort of the anti-lockdown lawyer, pretty far right candidate, very far right candidate for Attorney General of Illinois, and they're boosting him so he would be the candidate against Kwame Raoul. Mm-hmm. And this all, you know, seems like genius behind the scenes moves, but if it backfires and one of those candidates wins, it looks really, really bad. So that remains to be seen.
Well, other states are anticipating a red wave. Is Illinois going to have a red wave of some sort? I mean, we're all handicapping JB to win this thing. What about the other offices and the complexion of the state overall? Are you all hearing anything about that?
I don't think anyone's done any polling, head-to-head polling with the various. I mean, I think there's been some Democratic Republican head-to-head polling in the governor's race, but like for the attorney general, whether it's Kim or whether it's DeVore against against Raoul, I don't know. I haven't seen anything about that. But yeah, I think there will be a red wave in this country. There's no question about it, and that red wave is going to splash into Illinois. I don't think it's going to unseat Pritzker. But you could see some of the constitutional offices.
Well, JB was in New Hampshire last week, early this week, running for president.
Yeah.
which is kind of weird. And maybe that's the way every citizenry feels when their national politician or their governor, their senator or governor, sort of introduce themselves to the rest of the country. And you go, you're not a president. You're our governor. But to the rest of the country, it's a new, fresh face. JB was talking like a potential candidate, introducing himself, making self-deprecating remarks about his background, even his weight. But I don't think of him as a president. And again, maybe that's what every citizenry says in every city and state when their guy goes national. But I don't see him that way.
Well, they said the same thing about Donald J. Trump, didn't they?
Yeah.
look where he got. I just think, yes, you're right, John. By all accounts, a very positive reception to his speech,
yeah.
And people loved him. And like you say, it's a fresh face. I think it's a little bit premature to be campaigning for president. Of course, he says he's not. He says he's just, you know, trying to help other Democrats to be taking steps to make it appear that you're preparing to run for president. And for number one, first of all, he has an incumbent president that has not said he's not going to run for reelection. And unless he's lost his mind, he's not going to run against Joe Biden. Number two, he hasn't even gotten reelected to his second term in the state of Illinois. So I was kind of surprised that he's obviously unable to resist this temptation to get his name out there and to start talking presidential aspirations this early on. But I don't think it's a good look.
He's a great speaker. He delivers a good. Mm-hmm. I don't know who writes his speeches, but boy, he gives good speeches when he's got, you know, the full 20-30 minute opportunity to do something. I've been impressed. I've been moved by his rhetoric at times.
I found it interesting. The other big blue state governor that is angling for president, should Biden decide not to run, is Jared Polis in Colorado. And his rhetoric and approach to setting himself up for that position has been very different than Pritzker's. So Pritzker's speech in New Hampshire was almost sort of a fire and brimstone rebuke of Republicans as a whole. And meanwhile, during the same week, Jared Polis was on Fox News talking about how in Colorado they found a bipartisan path to work together and kind of a centrist mm-hmm. play to make their state really successful. Two very, very different approaches to kind of earning trust.
Well, is it safe to assume that nobody will challenge Joe Biden in the primary? I know that's not protocol, but these are strange times, and people didn't vote for Joe Biden to begin with. They voted against Donald Trump. I don't think Joe Biden's there as anybody's first choice. He's just holding the seat that Donald Trump doesn't have. I wonder how much pressure is going to be brought to bear on the president to not run again, or if there would be some sort of insurgency because Trump's just sitting there waiting.
Well, I agree with that, John, and I'm trying to think back through my recent history to think when an incumbent president was seriously challenged within his own party. Jimmy Carter, certainly, who had sort of the same sort of problems that Biden had, feeling people had that he just wasn't in command.
The day after the November election, there's going to be, like you said, John, extreme pressure on Biden to make a decision and about whether he's going to seek re-election.
And will it, if he's a lame duck, if he decides, says he's not going to run again, does that really change anything in the next 2 years if the Democrats don't have the House or the Senate? Does he have any juice anyway?
So yeah.
Does it make sense to give somebody a good runway to take off?
How good of a choice would Kamala Harris be for that?
I don't think that she's making a good name for herself nationally right now. I haven't seen the polls on it, but she hasn't had the kind of profile for vice president that you would think would give her the traction to run. But again, it's still really early, right? I mean, we're still 2 years away from this campaign, so I don't know.
Well, I think she's certainly going to run. If Biden doesn't run, she's not going to step back. But I agree with you. Her record is in terms of accomplishments has been mixed. Her profile has been relatively low. I haven't seen any polls either. But when I talk to Democrats, they're like, you know, give me anybody but Kamala. And I think what I'm hearing from Democrats, we're already talking up if Biden doesn't run, who? I think a lot of people are looking for a fresh face. Maybe it's not J.B. Pritzker, but they're saying that they're worried that the Democratic Party's presidential bench is not deep enough, and that you're going to see a lot of the same folks that ran last time, and if they couldn't prevail last time, what's going to make a difference this time? So, but you know, the Pete Buttigieg's and the Kamala Harris's and even Bernie Sanders, I wouldn't count him out for another run. I think they're going to all jump in like mad.
I feel about that a lot, Laura, the way I do, say, for Democrats running for president as I do Republicans running for governor in Illinois. You got all these people, but are any of them really that attractive? Can't we get a better candidate than that, either as a Republican candidate for governor in this state or somebody who is like, who's the next rock star for the Democrats as a presidential contender? And in either case, I don't think anybody jumps to mind.
What about Stacey Abrams? I like the cut of her jib. She's great. She's been an incredible political force down in Georgia. She wins the governorship this year. I can see it. I mean, she's impressive.
If she wins, yeah, she's wildly popular. She's very, very people in the base, especially women and people of color, get very excited about it. But she's got to win. She's governorship first, and then she'd have to turn right around and start running for president. Talk about unseemly.
I'm going to throw this out there before you leave, Laura. We got you for about six more minutes, and it's just one more local story, and that is times have changed, but kids have not. They're still trying to sneak inappropriate stuff into high school yearbooks. Someone at prestigious Jones College Prep wrote for their senior, quote, "Build the wall, yes, we can," Bob the Builder. The school issued a somewhat lengthy, heartfelt apology. They confiscated the books they could, and they sharpied out the quote. The school has a Hispanic population of, I think, about 25%. What would you all do if you were an administrator and the crime was as simple as that? That as a quote, a kid put, "Build the wall, yes we can, Bob the Builder."
It was a slogan for a major presidential campaign, and that you look at polling in this country, it's about 40-45% of the people believe that we should build a wall along the southern border to prevent undocumented immigrants from coming into the country. So it's not like a really fringy position. It's really not one that I agree with or would sign on to. But that when you open up the floodgates for senior quotes, you put yourself in a very strange position of having to sort of decide, well, is this political expression okay, or any political expression is okay? So, you know, my view on that would be to get rid of senior quotes altogether. and I feel like that letting it go through was not smart, but that taking a Sharpie to yearbooks in an act of like physical censorship is not a good look, that it may even have some First Amendment implications since it's a public school.
That was my thought, Eric. First Amendment, this is a freedom of speech issue. This is a young person's opinion. The seniors are asked to say whatever they want to say. It's been so long since I've been a senior in high school. I don't remember us having quotes in my day, but they've been given that opportunity. It's nothing obscene. It's nothing that's dangerous. It's nothing that's offensive. As Eric says, it's an opinion that many people share. I just think it's censorship, and the students that are outraged about it, I think, have a right to be.
I generally agree with it. I actually just had, my parents are moving, so I got all my old high school yearbooks like last weekend, and I looked through the quotes. Newsflash, like, none of them are too profound or incredible that like they need to be saved at all costs. So mine was actually misprint. Mine is like a bunch of gobbledygook because it was, there was like a typo introduced in it or something. So mine didn't even make sense.
Oh, well, but, here's your chance, Austin. Yeah. What is your senior quote?
Oh, no, I can't. It's from the David Foster Wallace speech called This Is Water, which was a commencement speech that he gave, which is great. Everyone should read it. Don't read my senior quote, but it was a good quote.
That was your head was there your senior year in high school.
It wasn't- yeah, I was a really lame person.
That sounds highly intellectual. Highly moving. I'm impressed.
Yeah, I don't think I had read like a single David Foster Wallace book or novel, and I was like, "Oh, this is really good." Yeah, I knew the speech or something. Yeah, so definitely a poser. But no, I think I would say either don't have. This shouldn't be an issue in a high school. Like, it's such a distraction, I feel like.
I hate to say this because we talked a little bit about it last week, but it does feel a little bit like the waters that the Naperville school districts are wading into when this fall they're going to consolidate the dress code for all of the schools, and I think it's District 203, and they are going to allow head coverings and caps as long as they can discern who the person is. So now what do you allow or not allow on the cap? We talked about that last week, but if you're going to allow Bob the Builder, yes, we can build the wall, whatever the hell all that means. It's kind of, there's a little mixed message in there anyway, but are you going to allow other things? What if somebody said all lives matter as their quote in the yearbook? What if somebody said make America great again? Once you go down that path of what's going to be on the hat or the yearbook, at some point you will find yourself censoring something out. I think Austin and I decided last week that the only hats will be the just monochromatic, like a red hat, a green hat.
Undercover cop hats, or those hats, you know, those hats that, who wore this? Rob Lowe wore to the Super Bowl, he wore a hat with just like the NFL logo on it, like one of those hats, or like the MLB logo. Just the most generic hats.
If you don't allow these quotes, these kids will find some other way around. They'll find some another way to get their message across. So, you know, you have to have someone, you have to have a set of standards, a set of rules, and regulate it. And it sounds like the school will drop the ball on that.
It's the same problem they have with uniforms, right? Is you can dictate for a white shirt and black skirt or black pants, and someone's always doing something, rolling up their pant legs or wearing skirts that are too short. But the kids do want to express themselves.
Dropping a hand sign or something like that, a signal.
You know, all the football team in my junior high yearbook, all of them were giving the finger to the camera. They had their hands down in their laps, and all of them were giving the finger.
Seriously? And that got printed that way?
Well, no, they had to go through the yearbook director, and before the yearbooks were distributed, he had to Sharpie out all the middle fingers.
Are you serious? You're just making that up.
That took some time. That took some time.
You're telling the truth there.
Yes, yes.
In my senior yearbook, I was on the basketball team, but I wasn't as tall or as good as I wanted to be. And when we took the pictures, I was in the back row, so I stood on my tippy toes, so I looked taller, like I was with the cool kids. But the picture was shot at such an angle that you could see our feet, so I'm the only one kind of craning his neck up and stretching myself a couple of inches taller. So I did look all of the 6'2" that they listed me in the book, but I'm really 6 foot. Laura, thanks for joining us on the Mincing Rascals. I know you said you would join us again, and we're going to hold you to that. We'll let click out now, but thanks for being part of the Rascals this week.
It's been great to see you guys. Take care.
That's Laura Washington from the Chicago Tribune and ABC 7, a political commentator and reporter. I didn't get a chance to ask her, but I will you guys, about the January 6th committee hearing. Did you get a chance to watch any more of the testimony today? I think each day they make, or have been making, that they've had the testimony 2 days this week, gripping cases with critical Republican players and Trump's inner circle. Cases that prove, if not criminally, that Donald Trump knew, he knew that he didn't win the election. This business about, I didn't lose, we won, he's still saying that. But the longer the hearing goes on, I don't think this is a small distinction, that you can tell he knew. The only two people that were telling him that he won the election were crazy and possibly inebriated, Rudy Giuliani and this Dr. Eastman, right?
And is it even clear that those guys really believed it, or were they just cozying up to Trump and going along for the ride?
That's interesting, because Eastman, boy, then it really is sort of the tail, the dog chasing the tail, because Eastman, when asked, said, we'll probably lose in court 7-2, maybe 9-love. I mean, you're right, Eric. Even he knew that this wouldn't stand muster. So he was doing it to make the president happy, and only he and Rudy Giuliani were the ones that were saying, you've got a challenge here. But at the state level and in his inner circle at the federal level, everybody was telling him he lost.
No, I think that's right. And I don't think it's crazy to think that those two people had some motivated reasoning for saying that he lost and maybe telling that to people. But I think the big news from the last 24 hours is sort of these texts released from a staffer of Senator Ron Johnson out of Wisconsin, suggesting that perhaps they were going to pass some fake slate of electors to the vice president so that it would create a reason to essentially go back and redo and recheck all of the electors. So when asked, I think Johnson's sort of excuse was that he didn't have an involvement in this. It was like an intern passed to a staffer done without his knowledge or something to that effect. But we may, hopefully we'll get more context besides just the, I think it was four texts that were maybe published and released, or that's what's been reported on so far.
Pretty amazing. I mean, that was an actual envelope with slates from Michigan and Wisconsin. They wanted to hand that fake slate of electors on to the vice president, to which somebody on the vice president's staff said, do not do that.
A staffer for Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson texted a staffer for Vice President Pence just minutes before the beginning of the joint session. This staffer stated that Senator Johnson wished to hand deliver to the vice president the fake electors' votes from Michigan and Wisconsin. The vice president's aide unambiguously instructed them not to deliver the fake votes to the vice president.
Even though the fake elector slates were transmitted to Congress and the executive branch, the vice president held firm in his position that his role was to count lawfully submitted electoral votes.
And Johnson, it was pretty funny because when the reporters caught up with him, he said, I'm busy. I'm on the phone. He was doing that, you know, power walk away from the scrum. He goes, well, I'm on the phone. And one of the reporters goes, you're not on the phone. And he looked at his screen and he did not have a call. You know, he was just kind of holding the phone up to his face or whatever, going, I'm on a call. And they called him out on it. And then he said he essentially didn't know anything about it.
Why was he even asking for that?
Because somebody delivered this to our office and asked to deliver that to Vice President.
Did you support his efforts to try to get those slates to the Vice President?
No, I had no knowledge of this.
Who's the person
I
that
had
delivered?
No, I had no involvement in an ultimate state of slate of electors. I had no idea this thing would be delivered to us. Got delivered staff to staff. My chief staff did the right thing. Contact the Vice President's staff. They said didn't want it, so we didn't deliver it.
Who's the person?
Again, that's the end of the story.
Who's the person that delivered it to your office?
I have no idea.
He had no involvement or knowledge.
John, are you saying that Johnson lied?
He, to me, is the most embarrassing of all of the senators in the Congress. I don't even think he's smart. I don't know how Wisconsin puts him into office. There's a lot of people in Wisconsin. Go get yourself another one.
Well, come next year, you may lose that title to Herschel Walker, say, or Dr. Oz. But well, that'll be really good. But the general thrust of these hearings is that we knew it was bad before the hearings began. I don't know that we knew it was quite this bad. And I'm thinking specifically of the stories on, was it Tuesday when the when the election workers were testifying about the threats, the horrible things that were have been said and done, and even Raffensperger in Georgia was talking about the threats. In the someone broke into his daughter's house, and it's just the level of simmering violence that's out there, the physical threats that people are feeling. There was a story that Adam Kinzinger posted a letter that someone sent to his wife, essentially saying that she was going to be executed and Adam Kinzinger was going to be executed and their infant son was going to be executed. And you know, obviously politicians get threats all the time, but this does seem to be at a higher level. We seem to be at a higher level of temperature right now in this country, especially with as regards to the threats of violence and violence itself. And that's what really has struck me about these hearings, which is that this is very ominous, more ominous than I thought.
Kinzinger said this is going to lead to violence, and then the next day, as if on cue, former Governor Eric Reitens from Missouri, who's now running for Senate, dropped his ad, which shows him going rhino hunting.
Feeds on corruption and is marked by the stripes of cowardice. Join the MAGA crew. Get a rhino hunting permit. There's no bagging limit, no tagging limit, and it doesn't expire until we save our country.
He's got a long gun, and he's got a tactical team with him. They look like military men. And then they kick down the door, and they burst into a home. The house appears to be abandoned. There's no rhinos there, but it's okay. There's no bag limit, he says, and you don't even need a hunting license. We've got to eliminate Republicans in name only.
And this is going after people in his own party.
Yeah,
this isn't. We're not even talking about Democrats yet.
Yeah,
they're going after Republican apostates.
But I mean, so. All metaphor aside, think about that. He is saying, "Go shoot Republicans who don't agree." Trump won the election. That is incredible to me.
He was leading, and I looked at the most recent polls that were posted to Real Clear Politics, and he was leading in most or all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, of course,
in the
this
primary.
Was they were in the primary, right? And this was all taken before this ad came out. And to be fair, a lot of Republicans were aghast at that ad as well. I mean, it was pretty horrifying. I mean, your description of it was very accurate, John. That this was a military assault on a house allegedly occupied by Republicans who were not orthodox enough for Greitens.
So. And I, in my mind, just put school children in that room because it looked like the size of a classroom, however vacant. The horror of the bullets and the sound from the commercial is essentially what those children must have faced. And I don't know how they didn't put two and two together. I mean, it's... I'm sure my reaction right now is exactly what they were hoping for, because I'm not the audience they're looking for. But who are they looking for? Who's giving that a thumbs up? Not just the candidate likes that ad. Where, you know, somebody directed it, somebody wrote it, somebody on his campaign team said that was a good idea, somebody financed it. I mean, there are just so many opportunities for somebody to make that not happen, and it happened.
It's almost similar to the. One thing I've heard a GOP strategist say sometimes when there's a candidate who doesn't seem conservative enough is, have them get caught doing something really conservative. And this is, to me, an example. So they put it out and then took it down, right? But well, the fact almost that it was taken down from their YouTube and Facebook. Yeah. Oh, Facebook took it down. Yeah, the campaign did not.
Twitter, you can still access it on Twitter.
Right. So he got caught doing something that media will call too conservative. And to your point, there's many Republicans who spoke out about this and said this is horrible. But I do feel like there's an element of almost political strategy here where you want people to be talking about how extreme this is. And that will appeal to some part of the base, which is certainly depressing.
Yeah, this is not a gaffe, right? This was not something that, whoops, this got through our filters and we made a mistake here. This was something that had to be well thought out and approved up and down the campaign. And so the idea that they would take it down or apologize for it just isn't there, that they're betting on this message playing well. And it might.
Is one of the messages, Eric, look, we got canceled. The cancel culture is, you know, ruining this country. They won't let us get our message out. Is that part of what you're thinking about?
Well, it's the Donald Trump fighting on everything. Trump never apologizes, never backs down. And he used language that was somewhat similar to this when talking about, you know, beating the hell out of reporters and so on. This is a new page in the Republican playbook, and it must be playing well enough that they feel like this is going to be a way to get enough attention. I think there are, four candidates in this Senate primary. This is one of those elections where if you get 30-35% of the vote, you're going to win. And then I don't know what it's going to do in the general election in Missouri. Missouri was where Todd Akin was in 2010. It's probably the same seat, actually. And he was the one who said something about, what did he say about if a woman gets raped, she can't get pregnant because the body takes care of that sort of thing. I'm paraphrasing, but that he then became seen as too extreme. And I think Claire McCaskill beat him in what was seen as kind of an upset because Missouri is a trending red state. And that could happen again here. I don't know who his Democratic opponent's going to be, but if he does win the primary, this is going to be something where I think moderate voters, you would think, would be fairly disgusted by this guy. And he's also got problems with some rather serious allegations from his ex-wife about domestic violence committed against her and against their young son. So this could be a knockdown dragout in Missouri.
You know, something else that jumped out at me was Greg Jacob, the former vice president's attorney, who said to, I forget who he was talking to, Rudy Giuliani or somebody, as they were petitioning them to go ahead and get the vice president to decertify these votes. And he said, how do you think this is going to play? Do you think that the states or 83 million people are going to say, okay, if we don't let Joe Biden be president? He said, this will be settled in the streets. And really, I think we don't even think enough about what would have happened if the president got his way? Like, to that large number of people that I don't believe, that believe that Donald Trump should be president right now, that Joe Biden shouldn't be president, how do you think that would have gone? Like, do you think 83 million people would have said, oh, man, they screwed us in that day in the Congress there? Okay. I mean, there would be rioting. There would be a civil war of some description. I don't know what that would look like, but that just wouldn't be tolerated, that you would never get away with this, even if that day Mike Pence screwed up the vote. It would not happen.
I don't know, John. I mean, the Democrats did not really get up on their hind legs back in 2000.
They would buy guns over this. They would go to the Walmart and buy guns over this, Eric.
Al Gore won the popular vote in 2000, and there was a strong sentiment among Democrats that he won in Florida, and that the Supreme Court took that election away from Gore. I don't know that has historically held up to scrutiny, but let's
George
say
Bush
that,
was not Donald Trump.
That's true, but there was no violence that I can remember in the streets. There was no, and the people were angry, but I don't know. That's not on the Democratic
brand. Even in that case, the Supreme Court weighed in on it. Remember, the Eastman's strategy was that the courts would not weigh in on this, that we'll just get away with it. I mean, even if the court sided with them, a court that in this case has been stacked with people who shouldn't even be there. Boy, you can't persuade me sitting here right now that cities would be on fire today if they thought that they were going to get away with it.
I do think there is a small but ascendant part of the Republican Party establishment, really based out of Claremont, the Claremont Institute in California. And their main philosophical kind of precept is that you kind of need a new American. It's gone so bad that you need a new American Caesar to seize power and just do things like you would do in a startup, for example. And I think among the many problems with this view, one of them is that they think that they would get order. And actually, if you were to do something like that, it would create massive disorder. Like you'd be more towards anarchy than you would fascism under that kind of approach, for the reason that you said, John, which is that you're assuming half the country just kind of rolls over and says this is okay.
Yeah, even Democrats. I mean, Eric, play it out for me then. I've got this apocalyptic view. How do you suppose the country would have reacted? Where would we be today if the president had been able then to persuade the vice president or somebody else to change the votes?
Well, I think that there would have been protests in the streets, probably violent protests in the streets, but that they would have subsided. It was the middle of winter in most of the country, and you probably would have seen a lot of protests, and then it probably would have died down. It would have transformed into some sort of political resolve, like, okay, we're going to beat those bastards at the polls, and we're going to beat them in 2022 and 2024. We're going to take our country back, kind of like what the Democrats were saying in 2000. They're saying, well, yeah, George W. Bush stole this election. We're going to win the election back from him in 2004. Now, of course, 9/11 changed the entire political landscape and I think helped Bush win the victory in 2004. But I just don't see sustained violent action from the left that would have overturned something like that.
I would have stopped paying taxes. I would have overturned garbage trucks. Not garbage trucks. You know, another just one compelling quote was from that Michael, is it Luttig, the Republican scholar. He was actually on the short list for Supreme Court, right? Worked for the Reagan team and the Bush team. And his speech was kind of halting. I don't know what exactly was going on there. But he did say that the former president and his party are a clear and present danger for American democracy. And again, that's from like a Republican conservative stalwart. This is not people that don't like Trump, what we've been seeing on this January 6th committee. These are people that Rusty, what was his last name? The Speaker of the House in Arizona, Rusty Bowers. He said he'd vote for Trump again, but you can't ask us to do the thing that you've asked us to do. I don't know if this is all silo talk, if anybody else on the other side is being persuaded or paying attention, but you know, you wonder what was going on behind closed doors. They all knew this was cuckoo bananas, and it's not a bunch of Democrats railing there. I think the questioning has been, however scripted, pretty measured. And they're just saying, tell us the story. Answer these questions.
Yeah, the net effect of this may be to push the Republican electorate a little bit away from Trump. I'm not sure it'll push them away from Trumpism, that you might see them getting mm-hmm. behind a DeSantis or someone who has almost the same positions as Trump, but isn't Trump. That I have to think that most Republicans realize that Trump is a really dangerous figure and probably a loser unless the Democrats run a really bad campaign and put up a bad candidate in 2024, that he is so polarizing and has done things that are so appalling to a lot of, you know, moderate, sensible people who might otherwise be inclined to vote Republican, that I'm guessing the Republican leadership behind closed doors is saying, we've got to ease this guy out the door, and that these hearings may help. They may help marginalize him some. We'll see what the election results are this fall. I mean, you're saying it could be really bad for Biden. They could also be bad for Trump, especially if some of his anointed candidates like J.D. Vance and Herschel Walker and Dr. Oz, if they go down to defeat. Some of them, I hope, will. And this may people realize that Trump, you don't have to be afraid of Trump, that the party can move on without him, because they really, really should. I mean, the once proud Republican Party is, I think, in shambles right now.
I find myself rooting for Mike Pence. Now, there'd be a primary battle between those two. Which way do you think the Republicans would go, conservatives in America would go in that case?
If it was head-to-head, I think Trump wins that pretty handily. But what's interesting is there's just, I think this came out today or yesterday, there's a University of New Hampshire poll that came out basically weighing Trump and DeSantis and who Republican voters has a better shot of beating Biden. And in that poll, it's the first one I've seen where, and this was of New Hampshire Republicans, which certainly aren't like everywhere, but there was higher support for DeSantis than Trump, which I haven't seen in other polling. And they also thought DeSantis had a better chance of beating Biden. So I think a Trump DeSantis primary is probably more interesting, and I could see someone like a DeSantis beating Trump.
I saw the news that DeSantis has declined to ask for Trump's endorsement in his race. So it may be that he is trying to create some distance between them that will allow him to challenge Trump. And his pitch may be as direct as what we were just talking about here, which is like, Donald Trump is just a complete loose cannon. And he says things that are offensive and troubling, and he's not going to win. And I'm Ron DeSantis, and I'm Harvard educated, and I'm way too smart to get myself embroiled in these ridiculous controversies. I will get only involved in controversies that I want to get involved in. And I could see that playing well with the people that have supported Trump, who like Trumpism, but don't really care for Trump himself.
What's worse to you, Trump or Trumpism?
Trump is worse to me because I think Trump has absolutely no guidelines or guardrails in his behavior and his ambitions. I think he doesn't care at all about any conventions or laws or anything. I mean, I really believe that about him. I think he's politically completely amoral. I don't know DeSantis well enough to know that or Trumpism, but I think a lot of things that most conventional politicians would concede an election that they lost, just for instance. And I think Trump is really a dangerous person. And I think that the hearings are showing that more and more every day.
All right, fellas, that's any last words of wisdom you want to lay on us, Austin or Eric?
You can contact your alderman through illinoispolicy.org/maps. And we have the best tool in the city to look up who your alderman is, which is weird. There should be better tools for that, but ours is by far the best. So if you want to have the speed camera tickets for 6 miles an hour or over, if you want that policy to stop, you can use that tool to call and email your alderman.
And my last thought is that the projections for turnout next week are really dismal. It looks like voters are going to turn out about, 25-30% of voters are going to turn out. And we are at a really big crisis point, I think, in the history of our country. And if you have ideas about how things should be run, if you're frustrated about the way things are going, you should get out and vote. I know not all these elections, most of them are not going to be that consequential on the national scene, that a lot of these results may be baked in. But just to get out and vote,
yeah,
and show the politicians that you're engaged, you're involved, you're paying attention, you're going to turn out in the fall. This voter apathy at times like this is very troubling to me and baffling. I really, really hope people get off their couches and get and vote next Tuesday. Even if you don't feel really strongly, even if you think all the races are decided, get out there and let them know that you're a citizen and an active citizen and that you're paying attention.
Yeah, if it's, I guess, nothing but a present vote, huh, Eric? I mean, just make sure that your ballot's counted with something on it, huh?
Yes, that would be my recommendation.
By the way, my recommendation was going to be a movie. My recommendation is good luck to you, Leo Grand. Two-time Academy Award winner Emma Thompson embodies the candor and apprehension of a retired teacher and newcomer Daryl McCormick from Peaky Blinders, among other things, is the charismatic and compassionate sex worker Leo Grand. As she embarks on a post-marital sexual awakening, he draws on his skills and charm, and together they find a surprising human connection. There are some scenes in this movie that are jaw-dropping. I thought it was really a sensitive, smart movie, and she's got a great touch, and he's good. I don't watch this with your kids, but do watch it with your spouse. And I thought it was a really good movie. On my scale of 1 to 23 jujubes, I'm giving good luck to you, Leo Grand, 20 jujubes. Very high. Fellas, thanks for joining us again, as always. Austin Berg and Eric Zorn. And nice to have Laura Washington's company.
Oh, man, she is, she's 18. That was really good. I hope she'll be back.
In the gaggle. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another pod on you next week. Good job, fellas.
All right.
Thanks,
John.
Thanks, Austin. Hey, by the way, I'm not doing this next week. I'm leaving tomorrow for Scotland.
Nice.
Don't want to brag.
Is Hanson,
you going to golf?
No, we will go up. I don't know if we're going to go to St. Andrews or not.
Are you going to Edinburgh?
Yeah, going to land in Edinburgh, go to Glasgow. I've been to Edinburgh before, but we're going to do about 8 days throughout the countryside.
There's a place in Edinburgh with a mat. What's it called? I'm going to find it right now. It's called Aha Ha Ha Jokes and Novelties. And the storefront is a big Groucho glasses. And I can't speak to the what's in the store, but I vividly think like, oh my God, that's the coolest store. Oh yeah, here it is. Ah ha ha jokes. Also fried Snickers. That's what they you can get fried Snickers bars in Edinburgh.
So back to the store, but the whole Edinburgh looks like Harry Potter lives there. Like,
yes.
But is it a bookstore, like a joke bookstore?
Or I think it's like like gags. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right, I'll bring you guys back a whoopee cushion.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.